Mystery presents Spontaneous Awakening, Session 11 with Adyashanti. My name is Tammy Simon, and what you are about to hear is an interview that I conducted with Adyashanti at the conclusion of a 5-day retreat held in Northern California. Spontaneous awakening. So the word spontaneous is pretty self-explanatory, but the word awakening to me seems to mean a lot of different things to different people, depending on how they use it. Mm-hmm. Different people are talking here at the retreat about their waking up experiences. So first of all, let's just define it. What do you mean by awakening?
Awakening really, really means that there's a fundamental shift of identity. Out of the personality, out of the mind, that the identity which is lodged in mind and thought and memory and me-ness is, to me, the true awakening is when identity shifts out of that. What it shifts into, really it shifts more into something that has no form, whether we call that awareness or consciousness or spirit. It's more important of where identity shifts out of than what we call where it shifts into.
That makes sense to me. I think the part where I get confused is the idea of this happening at one point in time, such that it's forever changed, or it's happening for people in little moments. And this is where it starts seeming like there's a whole range of awakening experiences.
Well, there is. It can be. I think this is a big misunderstanding that is often out there. You have schools or viewpoints that awakening is sudden in the sense that it's total or it's nothing, or schools of gradual awakening and all that. In my experience, I've seen that it's all... It all has its place. In other words, for some people, the awakening out of their personal identity is going to happen all at once and instantly. And for some people, it sort of creeps up on them until sort of at some point they just sort of notice that they're no longer really exclusively identified with their me-ness, with their personality. But it sort of sneaks up on them very gradually until there's a point that they sort of realize what has happened. So it can really run the gamut of how the awakening, you know, displays itself.
I think my concern when I hear people using the term is when they sort of state it as if something final has happened, that there's no more progress to be made or no more awareness increase. Is there a point in time where you've reached, quote-unquote, the end of awakening?
That's a good question. In one sense, yes. In one sense, when we're really awake, in the fullest, truest sense of the word, there's a sense of the seeking, the seeker, or the sense of more disappearing, really completely disappearing, and it is to be awake. So in that sense, there's an ending, but like all things in truth, they're fraught with paradox. So even when there is a sense of ending of the seeking, ending of the seeker, ending of the search for more or better awakeness or awareness or whatever, when that drops away, on one hand, it's a completion. There's never going to be more or less of the truth once the truth is fully realized. And on the other hand, there's also this experience, I talk about it as sort of on a human level, of the infinite revealing itself more and more and more. There's always the possibility for more insights, deeper understandings. Of course, there's a huge range of the ability to actually embody and be as a verb, as in the way we move through life and the way we act and communicate and the way we're in relationship with life and people. This is something that has almost an infinite capacity to deepen. So sort of both. It's an ending. Awakening can be an ending, but even when it is an ending, there's this sort of constant human unfolding and ability to embody it.
From the outside, is there any way to tell if somebody has achieved a type of final awakening? Can you tell from the outside? Can you tell with your students?
I can't tell just like some when somebody walks down the street. I don't even really try to tell. To me, it becomes obvious over time. As I watch the way they move, the way they relate, because to me, that's the proof. That's, you know, like I say, that's where the spiritual rubber hits the road, is how we move through life and how their relationship with life is and what that's like. There's a certain way that people tend to move and relate with their experience and relate with life that we can say is awakened.
And so how would you describe that?
No, that's very difficult.
First of all, you have to think of some people that you've seen that are awakened, so you have to start there.
Sure, sure. Okay. Well, in one sense, their relationship with life becomes, and this is a very easy word to misunderstand, but becomes very impersonal. Not impersonal in the sense of far away or cold, but impersonal in the sense that they are more or less free of the sort of triggering of egoic drama, the tendency to be enmeshed and caught by the dramatic movements of ego and reactivity and conflict, really. To me, that's one of the real hallmarks of really being liberated, is internally, not only the view of the enlightened view, the view of reality, seen as reality, but also on a human level, to have the lack of conflicting forces within oneself. That's a big part of it. And of course, when we don't feel conflicted within ourselves as human beings, that we don't have conflicting energies and conflicting ideas and conflicting thoughts, then of course we tend to act in an unconflicted way. But it's very hard to say that, like, this is what it looks like, because it can look so, so different from individual to individual.
Well, let's talk about it instead then from your own experience, the sort of before awakening and after awakening, and what some of the differences. Now, first of all, you were Stephen Gray.
Yeah.
When and how did you get your name Adyashanti?
Oh, God. That's a long story.
Well, at least like to know what it means.
Adya means primordial, in the beginning or before the beginning, and Shanti means peace. Yeah. My experience was really... was with the awakening, and I would say it's easiest to describe, or probably most practical, of how it is on a human level. I mean, because on the level of the awakened vision, it's of course a vision of oneness and unity, and on a human level, it's my sense of what really started to disappear was these internal conflicts, opposing forces within myself, judgment. Disappeared. I mean, literally, I can't actually come up with a judgment in the sense of the emotionalism behind judgments. I mean, I can think that something is on a relative level better or worse than something else, but that emotionalism behind judgment that causes us to go into conflict, it's almost impossible for it to happen, that sort of emotional response of judgment. What's left is sort of just discernment. I may have certain human as a personality points of view, and yet what's missing is the emotional energy behind those points of view that think that they need to happen, or they need to be asserted, or they need to achieve any dominance over a particular person or group of people. So it's not that like particular viewpoints or preferences, the personality will still has some, you know, preferences for, you know, all sorts of things. But it's what's missing is sort of the emotional fire underneath them. It's sort of like they're just there, but there's not this, they're empty. And so internally, that, for me, what replaces that kind of conflict and that sort of emotional thrust that is behind so much of our ego's drives and judgments and criticisms and wants, desires, that sort of very emotionally attaching force. In the absence of that, of course, is sort of a different passion. I would say it's just sort of an enjoyment. It's just, it's nothing really particularly special. It's just kind of your garden variety happiness. And the ability to see, you know, like my own ideas or my own preferences are seen as almost as objects of, they're funny. You know, they're kind of humorous.
One of the interesting parts to me of your story is that you didn't tell your teacher for 3 months after you had your awakening experience. I thought that was really cool.
There just didn't seem to be, there just really didn't seem to be any reason. It just, it was, it had such a sense of completeness and such a sense of, I mean, it was extraordinary in one sense, but it also was, had a very ordinary, it just didn't feel like something I needed to run off and tell anybody. I didn't feel like I needed it confirmed. I didn't need for it to be heard. I didn't need for anybody to understand. I mean, it was the dropping away of all those psychological needs. And the only reason I actually told her is after about 3 months, I just reflected and I thought, oh, this is what she's been talking to me about for 15 years and, you know, putting so much of her heart and her compassion into my process. And I thought it might be nice for her to know, you know, so that's where it came from. But there was just a complete lack of needing anything at all, which is really one of the real hallmarks, is you don't feel like you need to tell anybody or need to be patted on the back.
Your teacher's name, Arvis Justy, I read this in the Emptiness Dancing book. I'd never heard of her.
Almost nobody has, actually. She trained with quite a number of the really early Zen masters that came over to the country, Yasutani and so on, Roshi, and the last teacher was Mizumi. Which the nice thing was she trained with a lot of the really best, because that's what we got in this country. In sort of the first wave of Zen teachers from Japan, is a lot of the really good ones looked elsewhere because Zen in Japan had become sort of so traditional and institutionalized, and, you know, people would go to their Zen temple in the way that some people, not all, but some people go to church. You know, it's just like, oh, it's Sunday, we go to the Zen temple and we meditate. And they were looking for some really fresh blood, you know, they were looking for some very sincere people. And of course, when we're actually awakened and we're called to teach, that's what we want. And so a lot of those are the people that came over in those really early years. And she was lucky enough to be with some of them. When she was asked to teach by her teacher, he used to come to her house, to do some retreats, because there was almost no Zen temple, very few Zen temples around at that time at all. And he used to go to their house and they'd pack like 40 people into her house. They'd be sleeping on the lawn and all over the place. And after a while, one day he just said, you don't need me to come up here. You teach this now. And it was the transmission. That was it. That was the sort of, now you teach. But it wasn't sort of, there wasn't the, you know, the traditional Dharma ceremony. And she was very, you know, she was clear. She wasn't, you know, she wasn't cut out to be a priest or all of that. You know, she was a little older by this time. And, you know, she'd been around for a while and she'd raised 5 kids. And she had realized, you know, that although Zen can take that traditional path, she had seen that that wasn't necessary. So she wasn't drawn to that. And so because it wasn't sort of this, you know, real official thing, and she didn't put on the robes. And in fact, she'd actually took off the robes years earlier. And she just taught in her house, and she didn't travel, and she didn't advertise. In fact, she would go up every morning and set cushions out in her living room, every Sunday morning and sit. And nobody showed up for a year and a half. And every week, she'd put the cushions out and she'd have a talk ready and she would just sit down and nobody would show up. Well, of course, who's going to show up when you're not advertising? When you're not, but she just kept at it, this absolute, you know, dedication. And after a year and a half, one person showed up. And so she sat with that one person every weekend for a year. And then another person showed up. And so it went. And so she was, that was sort of her nature, you know. She never sought to be known, or she never really saw herself as a teacher. She didn't like the teaching aspect. She didn't like to give talks much. She loved to, the one-on-one encounter, the doksan, when you'd meet privately with her, she would really be quite beautiful, quite fiery, quite real in that setting. But she really wasn't, you know, didn't like giving Dharma talks that much. It just wasn't natural for her. And so she was sort of this very unassuming person. And it wasn't, you know, and by that time, now Zen's starting to get known, and people like me were attracted to the robes and the temples and the ceremony and all that stuff. And here you go to, you know, this little old lady's house, and, you know, she welcomes you in, and she's just wearing normal clothes, and you go in her living room and you sit down. And so on the exterior, it wasn't impressive at all. In fact, it wasn't until she suggested I go to a temple to do a long retreat. The first retreat I did, I actually came back after that retreat, and I was just blown away when I came back, because it took going away, doing a really rigorous retreat, and then coming back, and I could see, my God, what's there is here, and even more so in this little lady's living room and kitchen on Sunday mornings. There's as much Dharma, and maybe more Dharma here than there was up there, and I can't really communicate it, but it was really quite shocking. And she was so unassuming that I think the vast majority of people missed it. You know, they missed her. They missed what she was. They missed what she had to offer.
Now, you talk about your 15 years of Zen practice as, you know, banging your head against the wall, curled up endlessly, meditating to no avail. But isn't it possible that your 15 years of practice prepared you energetically, your architecture for this experience in some way?
It's possible.
Anything's possible.
It's possible. Yeah. To me, my experience is what it really did for me was it was the avenue through which I failed. It was my avenue. The cushion was the place that I went to war with myself. I went to spiritual war. I mean, I was trying to become enlightened, but it was a place where this sort of internal battle and my own personal will was playing out. And in that sense, I could look back and go, well, it happened. So apparently for me, it was necessary to engage in this with such intensity that I failed at it. That I found out for once and for all that I wasn't going to win this battle. And I finally let go of sort of my personal resources. So in that sense, it was useful, you know, but I think it would be really misleading to say, therefore, everybody needs, you know, to go that route. I think we all go whatever route we go.
You don't have any concern that the path that actually took you to where you are is not the path that you're teaching?
None. Mm-mm. Actually, the path that I'm teaching is very much the path that took me to where I am, in this sense that, well, like I just did a retreat, and most of the days we were meditating 5 or 6 meditation periods a day and a couple of satsangs. And to me, that was very, very much my experience was that there was meditating, but my spirituality really started to take off when I wasn't relying exclusively on my meditation practice. There was something that, even though I kept doing it, even though I kept meditating, there was, at some point, there was a fundamental shift where I was no longer relying on the practice of meditation. I could see this isn't in and of itself. This doesn't seem to be getting me there. This doesn't seem to be working. I didn't, therefore, just totally reject it. But then, only then did this other element start to come in, which was really, it's what I call inquiry. I really started to fundamentally question everything, actually. for me, the form it took, which was totally spontaneous, is whatever real deep burning question I had, I would go into the coffee shop at night after work and I would sit down, and whatever the burning question was, I would start to write about it. And I would write almost as if I was going to give a talk to somebody, because I think we all become the most clear when we're trying to communicate information rather than when we're speaking to ourselves, you know, when we're trying to communicate information to somebody else. So I would write these almost as if I was going to give sort of a talk on them. And what I would do was a particular question, I would find that every single time I'd eventually write myself into the extent of my knowledge. And sometimes it was literally right in the middle of the sentence, and I would just feel that I had nothing more to say. Anything else I said was just going to be mental nonsense, that I had written myself right up to my my wall, my stuck place. And I would write there, and then I would just sit there, and I would refuse to write another word down that wasn't authentic, that I didn't know was totally authentic and totally real, and that I knew was absolutely true. And sometimes I literally sit there in the middle of a sentence for 2 hours, 3 hours, and I just wouldn't leave until I could go through. And I found just by sitting there and just keeping my concentration right on the exact point where my own personal knowledge ran out and not moving from it, that eventually, sort of out of nowhere, something would start to flow. And I would start to write the next word. And I'd, sometimes it was one word and then nothing. But eventually I would write through and I would finish, and I would always come to a point of completion. This was sort of my way of inquiring. And the interesting thing that was, with everything I looked into, every question I had, by the very end, the answer was always the same. Every answer ended up to be the exact same answer.
And the answer was?
I am. So I can't tell you like the whole process, but one time I had a question of what is surrender. And so I wrote right until I wrote to the point that I ran out of all, right to my edge. And by the end, it wasn't an intellectual conclusion. It was something that I was feeling, that I was absolutely knowing, that what is surrender became, by the end, I am surrender. I am surrender. Surrender isn't something I do. Surrender isn't something that I achieve. The nature of my very being is surrender. And so every question I looked into, eventually the answer could be boiled down. It wasn't always stated like that, but it always came to the same place. It always came back to, I am. And even in this process, I would say that I was gaining access to a really deep part of myself. I hadn't had the awakening totally clearly. It was like I knew things. Things were coming out that I knew before I knew them. And they were coming out on a paper, and I knew that was true, and it was sort of a really transcendent knowledge. I was like, I was knowing things that I could only know from the awake perspective, but I hadn't been totally awakened yet. But they were coming out, and so they were kind of leading the way. And then, so this was very, that with the meditation was very much part of my process, this inquiry, questioning, looking at things very deeply, very intently. And then, of course, the awakening part is always spontaneous. I mean, there's no, like, here's the ABCs of how to wake up. But so when I looked back, I saw these two things, stillness and silence, and the ability to really be ruthlessly honest with myself, to not fool myself, to not tell myself I knew something that I didn't, and to stay with my line of inquiry. These two together were very, very, they became my spiritual path after a while. And they were, those two things combined is what I saw for me is what worked. And so you see, at this retreat, those two things are very much embodied. Now, I don't go tell everybody to write, because for most people, a lot of people, that doesn't, you know, doesn't always work. But that's really what the dialogue of satsang is partly about. Get that question and stay with it and inquire and go very deep into it.
So in that sense, you are teaching a path.
Sure. Pathless path. In that sense, I guess you could say there's a path, sure. Mm-hmm. It's not a path like, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. Or it's not a path like just keep walking on this path and you end up at the top of the mountain. It's not a path in that sense. It's not a path that we could say is particularly like, has the feeling of progression. But it's a way of being with experience. It's a way of being with yourself that actually is, it's unhinging the personal self. Whether you know it or not, whether you're conscious of it or not, it's actually deconstructing you. That's, if there's a path, that's, I think, what I'm doing more than anything else. It's deconstructing you. Silence deconstructs you, but for most people, silence isn't enough. Just meditating isn't enough. There's also this more active aspect of deconstruction, which is really direct questioning and inquiry.
Well, let's go into these two things just a little bit more, the inquiry and the meditation. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I love the fact that there's a path. That really, I feel a lot better, Ajay, knowing that there's a path. In the retreat, you were recommending people use the question, what am I? And mm-hmm. And I liked that a lot more, actually, than the who am I.
Who am I never worked for me either. Yeah. Because who kind of, even though for some people it works well, who kind of implied almost like an entity.
Yeah.
And what is to... It feels to me more open-ended.
But in your writing process, it sounds like you took lots of different questions.
Sure. Anything that was really, really, really important to me. Not, you know, just whatever question came through my mind, but the ones that were really, really, really important. It's so like when, at this retreat, when we're in satsang, as you know, I keep reiterating, constantly reminding people that the foundation. And that's why I call it the foundational attitude, the attitude of wanting to find out what you really are. That's why I call it the foundational attitude, not because that question is the only thing anybody's going to ask. Because as you know, people come up in satsang and that's not the only thing they ask. And there's a time when that question is totally appropriate. And I just like to sort of imbibe or transmit that underline whatever someone may be looking at, whatever question they may have, that the underline that this is what it's really all about is finding out what you are as the foundation. And then from there, then I always ask people to be totally honest about where they are, totally honest about what their question really is. So I often say, what do you want more than anything else? I encourage people to stay with their integrity. To really look at what's really, really important for them at that moment. Because that's what I did. My first question wasn't, what am I? I was looking at what was really important. And I know, not only from my process, but from teaching for a while, when people really ruthlessly stay with what's really important, that everything ultimately leads to, what am I? That's where it leads. And for some people, they're ready to go right there. And for some people, they have other questions to ask. You know, because they have other things that are probably, in many ways, more important for them to ask sometimes.
And then the way that you teach meditation is also a little unusual.
Yeah.
I thought it was unusual, at least. Sit with no manipulation.
Right. That's the no manipulation, if there's the how. If there's a method to it, that's the method, is when you notice yourself manipulating your experience for any reason whatsoever, to let go of that manipulation.
You don't care if people slump, what their posture is, it doesn't matter to you?
No.
Mm-mm. I'm curious about that, because that goes against a lot of training that I've had.
It goes against a lot of training that I've had, too.
Yeah. So why don't you care? I mean, don't we have to have the sort of yogic pathways open?
No. Well, I only say that because I've seen so many people wake up with slumping. So I always use what I observe, what my direct experience is. I mean, do you have to be sitting in the lotus position? Does your spine have to be straight? Does this stuff actually have to occur to awaken? And to me, simply through observation, simply through looking, simply through watching what actually happens, rather than any what any tradition said, it's very clear that none of that has to happen for awakening. Is it useful for some things? Of course it's useful for some things. It can open up certain pathways, and there's certain postures that are themselves more open postures. So of course that's true. What I found through my Zen background was that a lot of people were so intent on the correct posture that even though the posture itself was a very open posture, you know, a lotus posture or with the hands in the correct position and holding the correct mudra, even though everything was right, that their internal attitude was actually very closed. Their posture was right, but their attitude wasn't open. Their attitude was focused all on maintaining a posture, which was a very closed attitude. And what I've seen is it's the attitude that's important. If the posture and the attitude are one, then they're working. But so often, since posture is so, and to my mind, overly emphasized, that the posture is right, but the attitude's not open. And it's the attitude where is what has all the power. That has all the power, you know, is the internal attitude. And there's a teaching that if you have the posture, the attitude will follow. And it's just not so. Not for most people.
Aren't you afraid, though, that people are just going to sort of slump and space out?
I'm not concerned.
They're sitting in their lawn chair, kind of, you know, feet up.
Yeah. You see, I'm different, I guess, than a lot of teachers, I imagine, in this way, that I do not see myself in any way as sort of someone's school teacher kind of teacher, as anybody's parent. I'm really here to really talk to people who are actually really sincere. If they don't have the sincerity already, they're with the wrong guy, because I'm not going to give it to them, and I'm not even going to make much effort into trying to get them to pretend like they're sincere, which I know in a lot of, you know, traditions, I think a lot of it is, you know, the teacher's trying to make the student sincere, and I'm not saying that's wrong in any way, but that just doesn't happen for me. I'm just kind of like, if you're sincere, then it's your sincerity that's going to be really powerful. And if you're not sincere, all the posture, all of this, all of that, all of me trying to make you sincere, it's not really going to have an effect. So if you want to sit, you know, on your lawn chair and stare into the clouds all day long, that's your thing. You see what I mean? If that's what you want to do, then that's what you'll do. I won't pretend like it's sincere, and I won't pretend like it's leading to awakening if you ask me. But I'm not really in the business of trying to change what people want in any way. I'm just sort of here, if you really want truth, we have something to talk about. And the sincerity is totally up to you. It's not up to me, it's up to you. You're going to sink or swim with this stuff from your own sincerity. And if you have it, good. And if you don't have it, I'm not going to rescue you. So in that sense, I'm really sort of out of the babysitting business, you might say.
What would you say to someone who partially feels sincere but partially feels insincere?
Well, that happens. I think most people actually do feel that way when they get right down to it. You know, they have that sense of division. Usually what I say is I suggest that they really make a very deep, they look inside themselves, a very deep inquiry, very open-ended into what they really, really want. And to make no assumptions about what they want. And I often say, don't make it about what you think you should want, or what a teaching said you should want, or what you think I think you should want. Really look at what you really, 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 really want. And this is it can only happen, this kind of inquiry, if there's no shoulds, if there's no preconceived idea of where you're going. That's what I mean about integrity, their willingness to really find out. And what I found is, if someone really looks and sticks with this, with looking into what they really, really want, that it brings them much more to a unified place. It brings them there in and of itself. And to me, this is much more important than trying to get there as a discipline, like pretend like you want truth more than you want anything else. So people hear that kind of teaching, you must want it more than anything else, and it's true, but you can't pretend your way there. You can't fake your way there, because you can't fool your own emotional radar, you know, where you happen to be. And I think a lot of people are actually doing that. They hear the teachings and then they're trying to pretend like they feel that way. I go about it in a totally different way. I go about it, see, what I know deep inside is that if someone can look deeply inside of themselves enough, they are going to find that they really do want the real truth. I know that if they look inside deeply enough, that's what they'll find, because that's at their ground. That's at the, not only is it the ground of their being, but it's even at the core of their ego. Even their ego at its core, at its deepest place. That's what they find.
What do you mean by that? At the core of the ego? The ego wants the truth.
That the ego wants the truth. At its core, at its deepest place.
I thought my ego wanted things like, you know, more meanness.
It does.
Fame, power, money, sex.
It does.
All
it
those
wants,
things.
It wants, it also wants all that. But all that's a rather, it feels very deep, but it's actually rather surface. Surface wants, surface desires. Of course, egos want all that stuff. You see, of course they want that. But if you go even deep enough into the egoic self, deep enough into its core, you're actually, you're meeting the truth. You're meeting the divine. The spark of it is right in the core of the ego. That's why a lot of times what I do, I give the ego lots of room. Like people say, I don't really think I want the truth. I want to do this. And I say, go for it. Do it. Do it. And as soon as you tell somebody, you can do what you want. You can want what you want. Go ahead. Want what you want. You know, and they think I'm their spiritual teacher. I'm supposed to tell them something different. And I say, go ahead. Want what you want. Do it. I don't care. God doesn't care. Nothing thinks you're wrong. Nothing in all the universe except a thought thinks you're one for wanting what you want. Now go ahead. And it's amazing. So often when you give someone total permission and they actually really receive the total permission, that something deeper comes out. All of a sudden they drop into, well, now that I actually feel that I can want anything I want, I guess I don't really want what I thought I wanted. Now that I have permission, now that it's okay with the universe and God and Guru and the divine and everything, you see, because a lot of these sort of surface egoic wants are very much held in place by this sense that this isn't okay. And as soon as it's okay, it has no fascination. It's very much like adolescence. You know what I mean? Like adolescence is, you know, dyeing their hair orange, and as long as it freaks mom and dad out, they're going to dye their hair orange if they can get away with it. But if mom and dad are totally okay with orange hair, they're not going to dye their hair orange anymore, are they? There's no mystique to it. There's no allure. But before they find that out, dyeing their hair orange is about the most important thing in the world. They want that more than anything until there's no opposition whatsoever about it, and all of a sudden they don't want it. So in a certain way, I understand that the whole way I approach this is sort of completely backwards of the way it's often approached. But my approach is to really help people connect with their own integrity, and they can't get there when they're stuck in shoulds and shouldn'ts. You just can't get there.
I've heard you say that you don't believe that awakening is rare, that that's a myth that we have to dispel, and that myth is one of the things that keeps people away, you know, pedestalized. You really don't think it's rare?
No.
I mean, can we talk numbers, Ajahn?
Sure.
I mean, we're talking about
sure
tens of thousands of humans who are alive and awake.
No, I have
we're talking,
no idea
I mean,
how many people. The only people that I know about are the people that, you know, I encounter.
Okay, so let's talk those
so
numbers.
So I don't make projections.
Right, talk those numbers,
yeah,
just even that you
I
encounter.
I hear from other people,
dozens,
or other teachers. That
dozens
are going,
that you encounter?
Many more.
More than dozens?
Hundreds.
Hundreds that you've encountered?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So to me, that's a fair number. few hundred. Like I said at this retreat, and when I started to teach, I hoped that, boy, maybe one person would really, really awaken, you know, really deeply in a lifetime of teaching. If that could happen, that would be great. And, you know, like my teacher taught for 30 years, and not that, you know, that everyone who wakes up is going to teach. In fact, most people don't. Vast majority of people don't, and they're just not called to. But, you know, I've been teaching for, what, 8 years? Something like that. And so far I've asked 12 people to teach, and there's many, many others that were clear enough to even teach that they're just not really cut out to be teachers, you know. There's a lot more to spiritual teaching than just waking up. There's just sort of, you know, human packaging that kind of makes us adept at being able to do it. So to me, I myself am very, very, very surprised, to be quite honest.
This idea that enlightenment is rare, and here you are, you're telling me that it's not.
Yeah.
I think that idea, that's perhaps one of the biggest obstacles, because you get that in your mind.
Yeah.
Someone gets that in their, I have had that in my mind.
Sure, I had it in my mind too.
And so you sort of give up in a way,
mm-hmm,
on the idea that it's possible for,
sure,
you. It's only possible for a dozen people or something.
Because most all of us feel like we're not the chosen ones.
Right.
Most of us feel pretty ordinary when you get right down to it. And if we have this conscious or unconscious belief that this is for, if very rare, means it's for very extraordinary people, it totally contradicts our experience, because we're not extraordinary, most of us. And we feel very ordinary, and we don't feel like rare chosen people. And so this idea just is, it is one of the, if not the most powerful impediment to awakening. And our examples of awakening, they feed this, because we have images of the awake being. And they're all sort of, you know, halo and shrouded, you know, long-haired, flowing gowns. And if they're doing anything in life, they're always teaching. They always have disciples. They have people falling at their feet. These images are out there, you know. And yet, it's simply not so. It's just simply not so. It's very hard for our minds to get that, you know, enlightenment, it can look just like, it can look like, you know, your grandmother or the grocer. It doesn't need to look in any way extraordinary. Some enlightened beings are very charismatic. But you know what? Some unenlightened beings are very charismatic. You know, but these images, they really, really get in the way, that this isn't about in any way becoming extraordinary. If anything, it's just becoming ordinary. It's becoming who we really, really are. To let go of these beliefs is, I think, very, very important. Very important. They really get in our way. And they're just simply not true. People come see me. I'm a pretty ordinary guy. You know? Born on the West Coast, raised in suburbia. You know? Pretty ordinary guy. When I come over to my house, you know, we'll play poker. One of my favorite things to do. You know, listen to Frank Sinatra while we're doing it. It's, yeah, I don't sit around contemplating my navel every moment of the day.
Well, I think one of the reasons the belief that it's rare has become popular is that here are people, as you mentioned, who have been practicing for 20 or 30 years,
mm-hmm,
seriously, not really making the kind of large breakthrough which you described for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so a certain kind of grumpiness, cynicism.
Sure.
Otherwise, they would have to believe that they were a screw up.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
That's one place their mind could go.
Yeah.
One place, or their mind could, well,
or the path that they're following is useless, or, you know.
Yeah, that's a much more threatening one, you know. And of course, that's, I think, what contributed to my own awakening, was I didn't blame it on the path, but I blamed it on my relationship with the path. It's not working. And a lot of people around me had a similar relationship to the path that I had. And that's why I encourage people to to shake it up, shake it loose, let yourself question, open it up a little bit. Don't be afraid to question. You know, it only really caught fire for me in an intimate way until I finally could be courageous enough to ask myself, is there any such thing as enlightenment? Or are we all just fooling ourselves? Maybe it's just a crock. And, you know, it took me what seemed like forever, but it was only about 5 years to get to that point, to actually get there. What you think you'd start out at that point, you know, like what's true and is this true and da da da. But after 5 years did I realize I had been in many ways afraid to even ask that question. And this was hindering me in a big way because I couldn't look fresh with innocent eyes. Of course, some people get to a similar place, but then they go into cynicism, which, you know, that's just another way of hiding. But, you know, I felt very innocent, very like I don't know, like I want to know, very innocent, very open. And I think this is a really important thing. And to look at yourself and see what hasn't worked, what's not working, and have the courage to change, to move on if something's not working. These are very powerful things to look at, I think.